Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
I always had a private doctor. I didn't think I needed VA care. Then I learned VA is ranked above private care systems nearby and costs less. I'm getting the best care of my life with providers trained to treat veterans. Get what you earn. Visit choose.va.gov.
Not all veterans are eligible for this hyper amount of benefits mentioned here.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Hopeful Environmentalist, a podcast where we discuss hope in the climate movement and ways for you to take action with incredible guest speakers. It's your host, Taylor Gannis, and today I'm sitting down with Lily Woodbury to discuss a variety of topics related to plastics and taking action. We look at the Global Plastics Treaty, waste colonialism, the optimism pendulum, and more. And we even go on some rants and tangents, which I think makes this episode even more special. Lily Woodbury, using she, her pronouns, lives in Tofino, British Columbia, Canada, on the traditional and unceded territory of the Clouquot First Nation. She is the regional manager for Surfrider Foundation Canada, working on campaigns to address dominant forms of plastic pollution that are emitted from Canadian environmental law and policy. She also completed a Master's of Arts specializing in political ecology at the University of Victoria's School of Environmental Studies in August 2023. Additionally, I wanted to do some quick shout-outs on the podcast. If you aren't aware, I'm the author of the environmental children's book, Greenie LaRue and the Earth Crew, which is a book that has a mission of educating and empowering children to take action on the climate crisis. And the book will be released September 15th, and it's currently available for pre-order right now. If you're interested in buying the book and pre-ordering the book, I've linked that in the description of this podcast, and you can check out the cover and more information about the book on the websites that I've linked as well. But I couldn't have finished this book without the support of the wonderful people who donated to my Kickstarter campaign, so I wanted to shout out some names. Judy Fredette, Carolyn Winnick, Nicholas Alexander O'Hanlon, Jonathan Hill, Midge Iorio, Maureen Salerno, and Ian. There will be more shout outs in the next episode, so stay tuned for those. Before we get into this episode, we just quickly wanted to plug in that if you're enjoying this podcast, please leave a review on whatever platform you're listening on. Reviews help me not only better understand what you guys like to hear, but also gets the podcast more widely shared with other audiences. And if this is accessible to you, we do have a Patreon where you can financially support The Hopeful Environmentalist, as currently right now, The Hopeful Environmentalist is fully self-funded. For as little as $1 a month, you can help sustain the work environmentalists are doing to protect our planet. You can find that link in the description of this podcast. Your support is so greatly appreciated, and I hope you enjoy this episode. But now, let's dive into this amazing episode with guest speaker Lily Woodbury. Hi, so thank you so much for joining the podcast today. Super excited to have you on. So do you mind telling us a little bit about your role at Surfrider Foundation Canada?
Yeah, absolutely. So for anyone who's unfamiliar with Surfrider, our mission is the protection and enjoyment of the ocean, beaches, and waves for all people. And it was started where you are in the United States, specifically in California in 1984, by surfers who are really eager to protect their surf break from coastal development. And since then, it's blossomed into one of the largest grassroots organizations addressing coastal and ocean issues. And we have an affiliate here in Canada, Surfrider Foundation Canada. And so I'm the regional manager. I wear a lot of hats. I support our volunteer network with the community-led chapters and student-driven clubs. And I also support our advocacy work on the grassroots level with the chapters and clubs, and also at the provincial and national levels.
Awesome. So it seems like you have a lot on your hands. You're doing a lot of different things.
Yeah, pretty classic. Anyone working in a nonprofit, you're just running around like crazy.
Yes. Oh, 100% understand that. And I've worked and am working in a nonprofit, so always doing
something. You get it. You know, always hustling, always something.
And in the environmental space, if you're like, I feel like it's 10 times more of that. Like if you're a regular nonprofit, but then if you're like an environmental nonprofit,
you're doing 10 million different things.
Yeah, exactly. And it's sad because it really should not be that way. Having organizations who are working to protect and restore the environment should be something that's revered and just extremely well-funded, because we all depend on the environment to survive. Yet it's the opposite. And now I'm imagine it's the same in the US with everything going on, but we're seeing even more environmental funding cuts in Canada. So it's going to become even more challenging of a landscape.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And in the U.S., we are definitely experiencing a lot of funding cuts right now. I know a lot of nonprofits, especially in environmental justice, that are struggling with funding and struggling to get by. So it's definitely a very different and difficult landscape for nonprofits and anyone working in environmental justice.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so, you know, kind of talking about environmental justice a bit. So in your experience with working with coastal and marine conservation, you obviously see a lot of disastrous impacts of plastic pollution on marine life and ocean adjacent communities. So can you share what some of these impacts are and what you've seen?
Yeah, so plastic is a material derived from fossil fuels. It can contain a mixture of all kinds of chemicals. There's 16,000 different chemicals used in plastic products and packaging. So it does not break down in the environment, and it leaches all of these chemicals into the environment. And so it's going to persist. And when it persists, it's going to pollute ocean waters. It's going to impact marine life. So there's all kinds of marine species that have been documented eating plastic, whether that's whales, sea turtles, birds, and also animals can become entangled in that plastic as well. And overall, plastics really just threaten the overall ecological integrity of oceans, even all the way down to plankton, which are the building block of life, which are also eating plastic, which impedes their ability to produce oxygen. And so, yeah, it's a pretty nasty situation that we're in. It's also important to point out that plastics really blew up on the world stage as an ocean and coastal issue, because it's just very visible on the oceans and on the coasts. And also, of course, the impact on communities and for food security. It's also important to note that plastics create harm throughout the entire life cycle, from the extraction of fossil fuels, that transportation, the manufacturing of plastics, which often takes place in low-income communities, Black, Indigenous, and folks of color-based communities, including in Chemical Valley here in Canada and Sarnia, which actually isn't too far from where you are in New York, or Cancer Alley in Louisiana in the United States. And so that's why we really need to be addressing plastics along that full life cycle, which I'm sure we'll get into later on, because it's not just an end of life issue that waste management's going to fix.
Yeah, and I love that you said in the beginning how plastic comes from fossil fuels, because I think a lot of people either don't think about that or don't even know that this is coming from, so it's a part of the fossil fuel industry, right? It's not like it's a separate issue of, oh, it's like, yes, I mean, obviously big issue on its own, but like it's also contributing to our usage of fossil fuels. So thank you for pointing that out.
Exactly. And as we continue to decarbonize our energy systems, which is inevitable, this is happening across the board, plastics are the way that the fossil fuel industry is going to maintain and increase their profit margins. It is literally their plan B. And they want to ramp up production to 3 times the amount of the current state by 2050. And Earth systems, human systems already can't cope with the amount of plastics that are in existence. So that's why we need an instrument to shut it down.
Yeah. And I've like even read things about how they've been finding like microplastics in like unborn fetuses. And that's just like, it's crazy. So it's impacting all of us. So when we're like, oh, it's just plastic, like we're ingesting it. Like we're ingesting it through microplastics. It's in our water. It's in our food. It's insane. Absolutely insane.
Yeah, it is, all through our bodies. And in the safest place in the mother's womb, they're still finding freaking plastics. And so, yeah, it's absolutely a crisis that needs urgent attention.
Yeah. So another part of plastic and waste is this idea of waste colonialism. Can you talk a little bit about that and how plastic plays a role in waste colonialism?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so waste colonialism is really rooted in colonial systems of exploitation. So waste colonialism is really defined by structural inequities where global north countries that are often wealthier are wealthier, benefit economically while externalizing environmental harm to global south countries. And so with plastics, this can look like plastic waste, plastic textile waste, plastic medical waste. If there's like industry byproduct waste that's being shipped to global south countries. And so this has been a problem for a really long time. And there is an international instrument to address it called the Basel Convention. And part of the Basel Convention, there is Article 9A. I think it's 9A. And it basically, signatories to that article are prohibited from sending waste to global south countries, to unwitting countries. And Canada, and I'm pretty sure the US, I'm like confident we can fact check this and put it in the show notes. But I do know that Canada is not a signatory to that article. So we are still sending waste abroad. And this really blew up in the news a few years ago when China stopped accepting our plastic waste and Canada was sending massive sea cans of it full to the Philippines, Malaysia. And there was protests that broke out to say, hey, like, why would we take your crap? Like, deal with it yourself. And so, yeah, it's another massive problem that industrialized, wealthier nations can just, like, here you go, instead of dealing with it, put it onto another country, and then also espouse that they're leaders in addressing plastic pollution. So we are really hoping that Canada is going to ratify this article as part of the Global Plastics Treaty commitment.
Yeah, and I know the U.S. is sending our crap abroad too. So I'm guessing we're not signing on to that.
I don't think so. I'm very confident you're not. I should have checked that before.
Yeah, I don't really, this is going to be like probably controversial for some people, but I don't think the U.S. is at all at the top of environmental initiatives at all.
No. The U.S. is, I think it's the world's second largest plastic producer next to China.
Yeah. And the craziest part is, too, the U.S., when China also said, we're not taking any more of your stuff to be recycled and the garbage, the U.S. doesn't have even the infrastructure to recycle our own garbage. And I think it's like 5-6% of plastic in the U.S. actually gets recycled. So it's crazy. We have programs to, okay, bring your bottles back and you'll get.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, Spread, Totals, Player Props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
Some, you get like 5 cents per bottle you bring back. And we're like, oh, we're doing so good. But the problem is it's not actually being recycled because we don't have that infrastructure to do it at the scale at which we are producing plastic. So I always say to people, I'm like, just the best way, if you have the opportunity to not purchase plastic, obviously there's situations when people have their water impacted by pollutants where they're needing to bring in water bottles and things like that. We're not talking about that. We're talking about the unnecessary need of plastic cutlery at your barbecue that you don't need that at. Like reducing it where you can instead of saying, oh, I'll recycle it later, because that's not happening.
Yeah, exactly. Like, and even recycling is a broken system because plastics are an inherently non-circular material. They contain so many chemicals. And so trying to get a plastic product back into the same plastic product is extremely difficult. And a lot of the times, this plastic is being downcycled into another plastic product that will maybe be used once. And two, there's like a lot of waste to energy happening where there's like plastics are getting incinerated, and that's also being called recycling, which it is not, because you are completely losing that resource and then you're going to have to go and extract more raw virgin resources to replace it. And so, yeah, it's very ironic that so many of the countries that really just want, which I know we'll talk about, the Global Plastics Treaty to be voluntary and waste management based, because this is a waste management problem. Meanwhile, like you say, they can't even deal with their own plastic waste. They're sending it abroad. They're filling up their own landfills. They're incinerating it. They're doing whatever they can to deal with it, besides like just cutting down on production.
Yeah. And you mentioned this idea of circularity and like, it's not circular, right? It just, there's going to be an end of life at some point. It's not going to stay in use or in the system forever. So, you know, what is this idea of a circular economy and being able to have this circular production?
Yeah. So a circular economy, it has a few main components. One is that we keep materials in use. So any waste that's created from one system becomes the food for another system. It also designs out, yeah, waste and pollutants. It also regenerates natural systems. As much as possible, it relies on renewable energy and eliminates all kinds of toxins. So it's really there to keep materials in a closed loop system, whether that's wood, metal, glass, plastics, you name it. And this is important because this is what happens in the natural world. Things don't end up in landfills. The natural world is a circular system where materials are used, they return to the earth, they are always being reabsorbed and redistributed through natural systems. And so a circular economy is a way that we can emulate those exact same systems while creating more jobs, while lowering water, while lowering toxins, lowering greenhouse gases, because a shocking amount of greenhouse gases comes from our mismanagement of materials, that we are continually making more stuff that we then throw out, that we have to then go and extract the raw materials to then reproduce all the same stuff. Doesn't make sense. Except for the corporations who are profiting madly off of it. For everyone else, it doesn't make sense. And again, they're getting off scot-free because they don't have to pay for the pollution that they cause. They are fully subsidized by their ability to create pollution and not pay for it. So yeah, a circular economy has, it's really inspired me over the last few years. It's also been interesting to see it be kind of co-opted by corporations, like so many environmental words. And so hopefully we'll continue to see the term become more regulated and continue to see a lot of innovation and ambition as we work to really implement a circular economy.
Yeah. And speaking of like innovation and things like that, are there any innovative solutions that you are seeing or have seen that are tackling the plastic pollution crisis as is right now?
Yeah, one of my favorites is shifting to systems for refill and reuse. So community-led reusable systems, whether that's for takeout drinks, takeout containers, for grocery, that we have retail items like food retail, and also personal care items, whether that's soaps, detergents, etc., that you can come in and bring your reusables and fill that up. Also in basically every sector, like one campaign we have right now is called Bye Bye Mini Bottles, and we're trying to eliminate all the miniature bottles of shampoo and conditioner. New York actually has a ban on this, and this is what inspired me to be like, okay, let's get our province to follow suit. And hotels implementing the reusable dispensers. So you have a dispenser mounted on the wall, or you've got a reusable bottle, and they just get refilled with the amenity product. And all of these reusable systems, again, it like saves businesses money, it lowers waste, lowers greenhouse gases, lowers water. Often it's supporting local economies because there's people who are making the soap locally and providing it to whoever the supplier is. And so I really love reuse and refill and hope to see this be the solution that we continue to champion, because yeah, there's all kinds of, you know, technological innovations. Like my cousin said to me this week, well, what about all like the bacteria and enzymatic plastic breakdown? And it's like, yeah, that's great. But at what scale? We're going to use enzymatic breakdown to deal with the how many tons in the ocean and all in the environment? Like that's not going to be possible. And same with like the cleanup technologies. It's great. We do need to be cleaning up with the legacy amount of pollution, but that cannot be the main emphasis because we're never going to be able to clean our way out of this problem. And as I mentioned before, this just is not solely a cleanup end of life issue. It's the whole life cycle. So those are important, but again, I always want to champion the solutions that are really upstream and going to lower our dependency on production.
Yeah. And I love how you said, like, we're not going to clean our way out of this. Like, it has to be. Yeah. It has to be like everything, right? We have to clean up, but we have to stop producing as well. Like,
yeah. That's exactly it. I've been cleaning the same beaches for 10 years and it's so frustrating. And I've seen our governments in Canada, you know, in the US too, funnel money into cleanup, and then they're not willing to do the upstream changes. And it's like, you know that you probably save money because here's the solution upstream. And then we're not going to have to be out here using fossil fuels to be cleaning all of it up. And then it's so hard to recycle any of it. Like, luckily, we have one of our partners, Ocean Legacy Foundation, which I highly recommend checking out. They're incredible. And so they do recycling of marine debris. It is super industrious, and they're not like, no one's really doing that. Like, we're lucky we have them and we can send them our marine debris, keep it at a landfill. But even then, like, not all the plastics are recyclable because they are in gnarly shape, covered in all kinds of sea life, super eroded, very contaminated. So that's my thought on innovation.
Yeah, no, I could go on a tangent forever.
I love it. Tangents, welcome. Even though you welcome me onto this podcast, I don't know why I'm like saying you. It's welcome. It's your thing. You can do what you want. I'm used to being a host on these things, so I'm like, you go for it.
I love it. No, I love that. I love that. I really love how you said, like, and emphasize community led. I think the greatest movements and the best movements have always started grassroots and community focused, indigenous led, things like that. So I really think a lot of what we're doing and a lot of the environmental movement has been inspired by and from these movements. So I appreciate you for bringing that up.
Yeah, of course. That's where it's at. And with Surfrider, we work in local communities. We work with indigenous communities to champion, like, also be learning from the communities what the solutions are and be able to share the solutions amongst communities. Any change that we've created, we've done it in a town first, and then we're able to build that case study and use that as an example to be like, okay, this can work on a provincial and national scale as well.
And I don't know if you wanted to talk about your master's thesis at all, because I saw a little bit about it and kind of champions this idea of indigenous led being the way of inspiring environmental change.
Yeah, it's a great question. So my master's thesis was all centered around indigenous governance of blue carbon ecosystems. And blue carbon ecosystems are refer to coastal ecosystems that store and sequester carbon. So here in the Pacific Northwest, that's eelgrass, that's salt marsh in subtropical and tropical areas, that's mangrove forests, and they are basically superpowers of the natural world. From their carbon storage and sequestration, their ability to filter water, their ability to create habitat and nursery ground for all kinds of fish and other species, their ability to buffer coastlines from storms. Again, all of the wildlife that flock there supports jobs, including fisher people. So they're just really amazing ecosystems. And I started learning about them and I was like, this is next level. And most of, like, the historical loss is wild. And they are a natural way that we can continue to address the climate crisis while creating a cascade of other benefits. And so it probably would have made sense for me to work on something plastic related in school, like a lot of my contemporaries do. But I don't know. Like, Surfrider also works on blue carbon. And I was like, I feel like I should branch out a little bit because I can go onto the beach and tell you what the plastic is, you know, the plastic resin, where it may have come from, what the policy solution might be. And that was just felt very dark, that I was always in this place of, like, pollution and lack. It was like, no wonder I have, like, this dark mindset. And so being able to understand the natural world more and understand and get to know these natural systems and species was just really appealing to me. And so I'm glad I did that. And I worked with, so I'm here on the unceded and traditional territory of Tulokwiat First Nation. And their whole territory is a tribal park, which is an indigenous protected and conserved area. And they've got some incredible sources of blue carbon, including eelgrass and salt marsh. And these ecosystems are quite complicated in the governance sense, as is all of the coastal and marine, because you have overlapping local, provincial, national, and indigenous authority. And all of the state government, the colonial government, that is manufactured. It's not there in Canada as a this natural thing. It was, it's a, like, it exists because of colonization. Whereas the Indigenous authority is inherent. It is been here since time immemorial. And often the colonial governments, they're sanctioning activities that are degrading blue carbon ecosystems and other coastal and marine ecosystems. And meanwhile, Indigenous governments, they might want to put forward some sort of solution, but that might not be recognized by the colonial government. And so it was really all about finding ways to enhance Tulkoyo First Nation authority and doing that, like, in collaboration with these other levels of colonial government. And so, yeah, it was really fascinating. It really opened my mind up because I was, my understanding of governance was very low. And now I think it's probably better. Yeah. And so I'll hopefully be writing an article about it this year with a publication. And in 2 weeks, I'm really excited. I get to go and help out with Surfrider Puerto Rico's mangrove restoration program, which is all part of, like, the climate action program in the United States. So I really recommend folks checking that out, the mangrove restoration in Puerto Rico, if you end up going there. It's just fantastic. We need more blue carbon along the coastlines.
I love that. And I'm so glad I asked that, because this was, I feel like for me, even though I did a policy degree, I'm still, like, confused about government sometimes. And I think it's, like, this, yeah, it's so confusing. I'm like, wait, what's going on? So thank you for bringing that up. But then, so going back a little bit, when we were talking about the issues of plastic and things like that, how can we better address the impacts of plastic on the global level, local level, and even on the individual level?
Yeah, it's an excellent question again. I think, like, I've talked about before that so many of the solutions we've started in local communities, and we really need to continue lifting up local communities. The way that we will be able to continue to do that is by having a global plastics treaty. We need a single instrument because of the transboundary nature of this issue, well, this crisis, because of the state of globalization. And so that global plastics treaty, it's in negotiation right now. I was lucky to go to the last set of negotiations with Surfrider in the US and Surfrider Canada in Busan, South Korea. And they were supposed to finish it in December, but they didn't finish it. So now it's continuing this summer in Geneva, Switzerland in August. And so the treaty, to really be fit for purpose, it needs to have a cap on plastic production. One of those numbers that has been thrown out by civil society organizations is a 40% cap by 2040, 50% cap by 2050. And this has really become the cornerstone of the treaty. Much like we see with the Paris Agreement, it being, you know, limiting warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius, or like the Kunming-Montreal biodiversity framework of, okay, we're going to have 30% protection of lands and waters by 2030. So this cap on plastic production is really that cornerstone. And in addition to that, it also needs to be phasing out chemicals of concern. As I mentioned, there's 16,000 different types of chemicals that can be found in plastics. 4,200 of those are potentially hazardous to human health, which is absolutely wild. So we need to be phasing out those chemicals of concern. We need to be phasing out the plastics that we already have alternatives for. We are grossly overdependent on this material when we have alternatives. And it's going to take longer to phase out some applications, of course, but let's get the easier applications done now. All of the single-use plastics, for instance. Also, working on a just transition for countries and communities that have been really dependent on plastics and having some kind of financial mechanism to make that possible. That's a really important part of it as well. Again, really championing refill and reuse as the innovation we should be focusing on, which also, again, as I mentioned before, supports communities, supports jobs, sparks innovation. And so, yeah, I'm probably missing a bunch. Definitely not exporting waste to global south countries. That should be, like, everyone's got to ratify that article of the Basel Convention. And yeah, and dealing too with the legacy plastic, continuing to clean that up.
Yeah, so you talked about the Global Plastics Treaty a little bit. Is there anything else that you want to share on that, of like what we hope for it to accomplish, and have we seen anything from it? I know you said it's going to be happening again in August. Has there been any like work on it that's been effective, or has it not even been nothing so far?
It's a really mixed bag. There's been countries who have been ambitious. Like, there's a group of 100 countries, and they have put forward a proposal led by Peru that states, okay, we are going to be ambitious in this treaty. We need a legally binding treaty that is going to establish a cap on production. And Canada has been a part of that ambitious group, which is really exciting and really hopeful to see. So that has been awesome. And that's been a result of so many people making their voices heard and saying, this is important. We need you to be as bold as possible, because this is a once in a friggin' century chance that we're gonna have to friggin' do this. At the same time, there's also been so much pushback and so much stalling on behalf of countries that are plastic producers, really big petro states, because they don't want to cap on plastic production. They want to ramp up production. And so they're doing everything in their power to make this a voluntary treaty that just, it deals with the waste. They're like, you know, this is a waste management problem. It's not a plastic problem, which we all know is false. And also like contradictory, because it's like, well, if we had a perfect waste management system and all the plastics were being captured 100%, then this would naturally also lower production. But we know that can't happen because it can't be managed 100% effectively, because it's not a circular material. So yeah, we're in a really interesting place with it. It's going to be fascinating to see how it pans out. I'm really grateful for all of the presence from the International Indigenous Peoples Caucus on Plastics and all of the civil society organizations that have been there. There's so many incredible NGOs in Canada who are definitely farther ahead of me on this journey. And I'm just so grateful to learn from them all the time. And yeah, let's hope we can get a treaty that's global, legally binding, and super ambitious, and that becomes ratified by countries of the world.
Yeah, that would be, we're going to hope for that. And I think the biggest thing that people can do too, like you said, is when we use our voices, it's really powerful. So, you know, stand up for what you believe in, make sure you're signing petitions, make sure you're having your voice heard when not even when there's the ability to, of like, okay, there's a public hearing or something, just always, your voice matters. So make it heard.
Totally. Totally. And I imagine there'll be folks in Canada and the US who listen to this. Like, there's Surfrider in New York where you are. There's Surfrider all through the States, all through Canada. And it's a way to learn how to become civically engaged. And so Surfrider tries to make it easier and more accessible for people, because I've talked to a lot of folks and they do find it daunting, like going and talking to their elected representatives. And so Surfrider does try to make it more accessible and make it fun and make it community based, where you're going with groups of people. And I think, like, speaking on the individual part, there's lots we can do in terms of our lifestyles. It's always going to be limited within the systems we're working within, because if you don't have clean water, you're going to drink plastic. If you don't have fresh food and all your food is packaged in plastic at the supermarket, you're going to use that. If you don't have money to buy organic clothing, you're going to buy fast fashion. So I always I'm like, do what you can, but recognize the systems are broken, and that's what we need to change. I think individuals can also spark systemic change in their communities as well. So Surfrider has ocean-friendly restaurants, ocean-friendly hotels in the United States. So for anyone listening, if they work at a restaurant or a hotel, they can sign up their workplace to be part of this program to reduce plastics. And similarly, in Canada and British Columbia, we have the Water Friendly Business Program, which again is also focused on plastic reduction and enhancing circularity. And so, yeah, from our personal lifestyle to getting out there in our workplaces and institutions, and again, doing what we can to make our voices heard and working to change the systems.
Yeah, and all the resources that you brought up, would love to link those later so people can click on them and find them. Absolutely love that. Okay, so, you know, when we look to the future, it's hard to not feel this scared, alone, anxious, doom feeling, and just so many other emotions. So what is this idea of an optimism pendulum? And, you know, we've given ways of how people, some ways of how people can take action. So how can we utilize this theory to create a better world and a more equitable future?
Yeah, I really like the climate optimism pendulum as a framework because it basically takes the pendulum and it can swing to either side. And let's say on this side, we have feeling despair, feeling eco-anxiety, feeling just hopeless. And then on the other side, it's like maybe we're actually just so complacent, we're not even caring. We're like, it's all good, it's all fine. And so we want to have the self-awareness to know where we're at on that pendulum, because if we're too far to the one side, we might just be complacent and we are like, okay, well, this isn't really a problem. I don't have to do anything. This is all a hoax. You know, there might be denialism or just straight up like apathy because you're like, this isn't a huge problem. And then on the other side, you might be like so aware of how bad it is that you're also not in a state to really galvanize and make change. And so having that awareness, and then we can kind of like self-correct of where we need to be, like somewhere on more of a balance point on the pendulum. And a lot of this comes into what we're doing and the information we're taking in. And so a lot of our media is extremely negative. That is very much by design, I think. The more we intake negative media, the more we want to consume. It's called the terror management theory. We want to consume Netflix, online shopping, food, alcohol, whatever it is, we're going to be consuming more. That supports our consumer capitalist society. And so we need to be seeking out more of a balanced information diet, because there is amazing progress happening all the time. We have made major advancements as humanity. I can vote. You and I can both vote. Decades ago, we couldn't vote. We didn't have all kinds of rights. And right now is an interesting situation because a lot of rights are being called into question and are being deteriorated in Canada and the US. At the same time, like, the point is that we have made so much progress and we have to keep our eye on that, because that is going to give us the hope and the optimism that, okay, we can continue to reach these other milestones in terms of how we want to evolve as a society, addressing plastic pollution, addressing the climate crisis, addressing systemic inequities and colonization and capitalism, corporate hegemony, the list goes on and on. And so with the optimism pendulum, being wary of the information we're taking in so we can get to a balanced place, and also by taking action. The people I find who are the most hopeful are the ones who have their hands in the sand, in the water, in the boardrooms, involved and invested in some kind of solution. So if you're invested in the solution, you can see that a better world is possible because you're also surrounded by other people who are involved in the solutions. A lot of the people who I find can just be like a bit nihilistic about it, aren't involved, and they're just reading stuff on their phone. It's like, well, I'm going to be honest, it's not helpful. And if you are just feeling nihilistic and not doing anything about it, and that shows me that you're probably not directly impacted. Like, so many folks in the world are on the front lines of natural resource extraction and the climate crisis and systemic inequities, and they don't have a choice but to fight because their lives and their health are on the line. And so for so many of us, like myself, I have the option. And I'm like, as long as I have the option and other people don't have a choice, I should absolutely be out there and doing something. And that's what I try to tell everyone. It's like, if you are feeling hopeless and you're not impacted, like, to me, that's a sign that you have degrees of privilege, because you can, like, I don't know, insulate yourself while also feeling hopeless about it, which is so wax. It's like, yeah, you're still eating, you're still breathing, you still live in an incredible place, like where I live here in Tofino. It's just absolutely stunning. And it is stunning as a result of people being politically active and shutting down clear cutting. This is a long tangent on the optimism pendulum. All that to say, having a self-awareness of where we're at in terms of like our own attitudes and beliefs and state. Like, oftentimes if I become really anxious or feeling a bit depressed, it's like, okay, I need to turn the news off. I need to just like get back into the natural world, go and surf, go and spend time outside, get involved in the solution and kind of chill out for a bit. If I start feeling like I'm a bit distracted and it's like, oh no, maybe it is okay. I mean, I don't really think I ever go that far, to be honest, because I'm just so ensconced in the details of what's happening. That's like, okay, maybe I need to be reading more of the reality of what's going on, which I think a lot of people should be. they should be reading like stories about folks who are directly impacted to get a bit of a reality check.
Yeah, no, everything you just said, chef's kiss, like absolutely love it. Like
roundabout day. I woke up with a cold.
No, I love it. And I think it's so important because, you know, I've been hearing a lot about like people talking about hope a lot and they're like, oh, well, hope is like, it's we have to stop being hopeful. We just have to start like taking action. And I'm like, but I think, and how I, you know, try to put out my information to the world is that it's not just hope that we're putting out, we're putting out resources. It should make you empowered to take action. So there's all these bad things that are happening. We're reading about it. And we, like you said, we need to be reading about it. We need to know about it, but we also need to be reading and learning about the solutions. And when we have this hope, when we leave with this hope, we can say, okay, well, I know there's a problem over here, but I know that there's solutions to fix it because I learned about how I can be hopeful and the hopeful news and solutions that are happening. I can take part to help. So I think it's important to know that, like, as the hopeful environmentalist, we're not just saying, here's some great news, go on with your days. No, it's like, here's hope. There's solutions, right? We talked, like, even on this podcast right now, we talked about the not so good. And we talked about there's so many solutions, though. They exist. The bad is here, but the solutions are also here. And here's the resources for you to now go out into the world and make change.
Yeah, exactly. You nailed it. The hope has to be hand in hand with the action. And there's a really great book by Joanna Macy called Active Hope. And that's the whole concept of it. And it really is like also has like a lot of rootedness in ecological spirituality, which is really cool as well. So I need to reread it. It's been like a decade since I've opened it. But yeah, that's it. It's like to have hope, we have to also be living the actions and yeah, keeping like a nuanced perspective of it, that there is, we have had a lot of losses and there is a lot of challenges that we are up against, but it is not impossible and we cannot throw in the towel. We can't do that to the rest of our humanity, to future generations, to the previous ancestors who have worked so hard for us to have the rights that we have now. Literally, they spent their days and years and decades fighting for our rights, and we're going to throw in the towel? Like, absolutely not. This is a multi-generational responsibility that we have. And, you know, like, let's get it and let's do our best. And even if, let's say, we did freaking fail, then at least we lived a meaningful, purposeful life of trying to do our best and mitigated a heck of a lot of damage. But I feel more hopeful than that. I know that we can turn it around, but we need as many of us as possible coming together.
I love that. Yeah. And speaking of coming together and taking action, first of all, I have to read that book. I've never heard of it before. So I'm going to have to read it.
I love it.
But then also, people listening to the podcast right now, what can they do to protect our oceans and the planet from plastic pollutions? And like, what are ways that they can get involved right now?
Yeah, it's a great question. I would say like, find out if you have Surfrider near you. If not, if there's another organization addressing plastic pollution so you can get involved in advocating for stronger plastic policies in Canada and the US, so that you can advocate for plastic-free businesses and plastic-free schools and your plastic-free workplaces. We need changes at all those levels. And the more we can get like work on schools happening and workplaces, we create the case studies to pass the policy. So really getting involved on those levels. Again, doing what we can at home, like find your local refillery and start, you know, switching stuff over at a pace that's sustainable for you. Like I haven't been doing this all at once. I needed some new pans. I got some plastic-free, non-toxic ceramic ones. I needed new pillows. I got organic ones that are not synthetic. And the synthetic ones, which is a whole other sideline, are terrible for us. We should not be using them. And same thing with our kitchen refillables and our personal refill stuff from shampoo, conditioner, toothpaste. So just slowly shifting all of that over as well. And continuing to, you know, this comes back to like the policy stuff, but yeah, really making our voices heard to our elected representatives, that we need ambitious action on plastic and we need a global plastics treaty, because the countries that have been ambitious, they're the ones who's, they're listening to their constituents, which is how it should be. The governments are here to serve us. So hopefully that's, we'll leave folks with some next steps that they can work on. There's multiple different junctions you could jump in there, but we have to do something.
Yeah. And I always love giving like multiple ideas for how to take action, because not everything right now in our current system is accessible to everybody. So love that you provided
exactly
different ways.
Exactly. Like someone might be like, they might work at a hotel. They're like, oh, they use all kinds of plastics. I can become the sustainability lead and start phasing a bunch of this stuff off. Or they might be a student and they can join an existing Surfrider club or create a Surfrider club and work to create a plastic-free campus. Or someone in a community, you know, they might work for themselves, but they've got a Surfrider chapter and they can join on and start working on plastic policy. So yeah, there's lots of different things.
And lastly, what I love to ask everybody is, what brings you hope for the future of our world and its inhabitants and systems?
Yeah, that is a really good question of what brings me hope. I think in the last 14 years that I've been on this journey, I started getting into environmentalism when I was 18 and started my undergraduate degree at that point. And now I'm turning 32 next month, which is wild. I've seen literacy just skyrocket. Trying to talk to people about the climate crisis and plastic pollution and biodiversity loss and the intersection between social inequities and environment, environmental injustice, it was really challenging. I feel like I had to really got into a lot of interesting debates with people. And overall, the literacy just wasn't there. And seeing just in 14 years how much that has changed, how aware people are, it gives me a lot of hope. And that everyday people are seeing that they can reclaim their power to shape the world. Because there's not some technological messiah. I think what the tech industry has shown us, its colors. We cannot trust them to create the change that we need on like that major big tech level. There's obviously lots of tech companies that are doing awesome stuff, and shout out to them. There's no messiah individual who is going to save us. It has always been everyday people. It's always going to be everyday people. And we are the true badasses of the world by creating and leading the solutions. And so that's what gives me hope, is that we are going to continue to take off celebrities and billionaires and elite politicians off this pedestal and continue to raise up indigenous peoples, continue to raise up local communities, continue to rise up people of color, continue to rise up animals, ecosystems, everyone, all of each other, because we're the ones who are going to turn this around and always have and always will.
I love that. I love everything that you just said.
So sweet.
I especially of like when we put these like celebrities and these billionaires on a pedestal, I'm like, why? Like, there's so many people on the grassroots level. Oh. There's indigenous people. It's just, we're all, these are the people that we need to be amplifying. Not who cares what wore to the Met Gala? Like, no one cares.
Oh, no. Yeah, I've got some choice words for it, but I haven't sworn so far. So
feel free to say whatever you want.
I've kept my record clean on here. I should always go in and ask, because I do swear a lot. But then I'm like, if I'm doing it and I'm representing Surfrider, I'm like, I need to keep this. I need to keep it.
No, you can always, if you ever come back on the Helpful Environmentalist, which you are very welcome to, you can say whatever you want. Any curse words are allowed.
I love it.
So that is all I have. Is there anything else that you want to add before we wrap up?
No, I think we've covered a really great range. I love your questions. I really love what you're doing with the podcast and your platform. It's such an important message right now for people to feel hopeful and have ways to take action, because this information hasn't been accessible. A lot of us, like, I didn't have environmental education in elementary and high school, and a lot of folks, it's the same. So I'm really grateful for your platform, and just keep rocking it, and come visit Vancouver Island. Come see how cold it is.
Yeah, no, I definitely need to. I appreciate you coming on today. So thank you so much for joining the podcast.
Yay, thank you. Enjoy the rest of the day.
Thank you all so much for listening to this episode of the Hopeful Environmentalist podcast. If you're interested in checking out Surfrider to see events near you and how to take action, all those links are included below in the episode description. And if you're interested in pre-ordering my children's book, Greenie LaRue and the Earth Crew, you can also check out the description of this episode. As always, remember to stay hopeful and create positive change.